You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Despite the trillions of dollars the United States has spent on national security since World War II, many Americans feel that we're less safe today than we were 65 years ago. And David Unger, who is a member of the New York Times editorial board and on the Council of Foreign Relations, is one of them. In his new book, The Emergency State, Mr. Unger describes how exceptional, that is, extra-constitutional measures first adopted by Franklin Delano Roosevelt to fight Nazi Germany have permanently changed how the United States government has operated and opened the door for subsequent presidents to engage in wars that have both damaged the country economically and made it less secure. The book is published by the Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased that it has brought David Unger to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Wasn't the U.S. Constitution designed by its framers to prevent the United States from becoming embroiled in an endless cycle of wars because they'd seen how destructive that had been in Europe?
Yes, they were. And it was a particular kind of war that bothered them. You have to remember that America was born in the era of the Napoleonic Wars, and Britain was in it and France was in it. Those were our trading partners. We couldn't really stay out. What they wanted to stay out of was permanent entangling alliances that got them into wars that weren't our cause, that were other countries' causes.
And James Madison, the Constitution's principal author, mandated a check on executive power specifically to avoid unnecessary or unwise military interventions.
Madison and even Hamilton, the great champion of executive power, understood that the great republic's previous experiments in republican government, Renaissance Italy or whatever, had succumbed when they had gotten into a situation of chronic war.
So what happened? Over the next 150 years, that system was in place, and yet we still got into the Mexican War, which sounds is a war that we can't be proud of, the Spanish-American War.
Well, I think that we did live within our constitutional system for about 150 years. We didn't design a pacifist republic. That Second Amendment right to bear arms are there for two reasons. It was there to protect against tyranny so that the citizenry would not be disarmed, but it was also there in order to have the well-regulated militia, as the language says, that could be summoned to defend the country.
So when constitutional rights were suspended for a while, like habeas corpus during the Civil War, they were then restored right after the war.
That's the difference between our era and the rest of American history. Wartime emergency states are not unusual. Woodrow Wilson with the Sedition Acts and the Espionage Act, fine in wartime. But when the war was over, the emergency state ended, and you knew when the war was over. Since we've had a peacetime emergency state, when exactly do we go back to constitutional government?
Although I'm going to address Woodrow Wilson in just a moment, he seems to me to be the real beginner of this whole process in many ways. You've said that the government now functions as if it were in a permanent state of emergency. Does it matter which party the president is from?
Well, it matters. What matters is that we again have elections that have meaningful debates about what kind of foreign and national security and constitutional policy we're going to have. It always matters. I think you'll see that while all presidents, say, from Truman and Eisenhower forward, were emergency state presidents, the earlier Republicans in there, certainly Eisenhower with the concerns for the military-industrial complex, were concerned about solvency and means and not containing our global ambitions.
Although Eisenhower was one of the people who helped continue the development of the military-industrial complex when he was president.
Yes.
Then he leaves. He says, well, we shouldn't have done it.
Yes.
Well, we shouldn't do it in the future.
I think it's important to remember that speech was made 3 days before he left office, after 8 years of doing it.
Well, as you said, in the past, things would change after the emergency. And that doesn't happen anymore. Barack Obama campaigned on an end to some of the excesses, as he described them, of the Bush administration. And yet right now we see him continuing many of those things. The sense is that once a door has been opened, nobody is willing to go back and close that door anymore.
That's the sense. I think the mystery of Obama is still being unraveled, because although he says that people read a lot into him that he wasn't saying in that 2008 campaign, if you go back at some of those statements, he clearly was saying that he was going to do things about Guantanamo, about torture, that he hasn't done. He's been an emergency state president, and I think if the democratic process works properly, his supporters will ask him to explain himself in the course of the campaign.
On the other hand, it might be said that it would be politically inexpedient for him to do anything different, and I think that could be said for many presidents. Every time we talk about cutting back on military budget, there are screams from all over the country, and if you object to the budget being too high, you're called un-American.
That's the problem, and the two parties are co-enabling each other. I mean, there are differences between the parties, but everybody's afraid of the other one's soundbite, and they drive, as we see very much in this campaign, reduce the real issues, the difficult issues before us, Iran, Syria, defense budget, to soundbites that are really thoughtless. And I'd like to see, the one reason I wrote this book is to get the real issues raised in the campaign year.
My guest is David C. Unger. He's written a book called The Emergency State, America's Pursuit of Absolute Security at All Costs. And although you pin much of the blame for how things have developed on FDR's shoulders, you've pointed out that Woodrow Wilson contributed to the problem, as I mentioned earlier. Is it your contention that the way Wilson framed the First World War in terms of good and evil, that's made it difficult for the public to think clearly about their real interests in the world?
Broadly, yes. I think that a war that Wilson himself knew, and if you read his war address to Congress, knew that the United States had a definite, specific national security and economic interest in keeping Atlantic shipping lanes open and keeping Europe open to free trade and not the preferred German system of closed trade, German Empire trade. But he didn't make that case. He made an idealist case which had no limits. You know, it's often framed as Wilsonian internationalism versus isolationism, but the real other side of that debate at that time was Teddy Roosevelt, who no one could call an isolationist. He was a different kind of internationalist.
He was an expansionist.
He was an expansionist, and he won the Nobel Peace Prize for mediating the Russo-Japanese War. He was interested in the world. He's the father of the two-ocean navy, the Great White Fleet.
Do you think that Wilson really believed it when he said that World War I was the war to end all wars?
I think he did, unfortunately.
Well, the interests were mainly economic, considering the ability of the United States to trade with Europe that Wilson was concerned with. So do we owe our current politicians fondness for couching so many of their foreign policy proposals and decisions in moral terms to the precedent of Woodrow Wilson?
I think so. I think, you know, I find that what Franklin Roosevelt, I don't make him the villain. I just make him the person who did it first.
You call him the godfather.
The godfather,
of America's emergency
right.
State.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, Marlon Brando is a somewhat sympathetic character. I think that
he didn't mumble.
He didn't mumble, it's true. No, he was a very good speaker and he was a very good politician. And it's important to remember he was running for the unprecedented third term in the crucial months that he was waging what we would today call a presidential war. I think that here is a man who wasn't going to lose the 1940 election, but lived in terror that of the what he would call the natural isolationism of the country and not provoking it. He said things like, you can believe I'm not going to send your sons to fight in a foreign war, which he later explained that it wasn't a foreign war since we were in it. Well, I think that was a little misleading.
Although he had no choice. Japan did attack the United States. There are some people who say that he knew what was happening, although those are mostly conspiracy theorists. But let's look at some of the things that you think led to him being termed by you the godfather of America's emergency state. He used his authority to begin using U.S. naval forces to protect British ships from German attacks in the Atlantic Ocean without congressional approval 2 years before Congress declared war on Japan and Germany.
Right.
Was that the equivalent of FDR exercising war powers before there was a formal declaration of war?
I think that was. I think that putting aside that the cause that Roosevelt was doing it in was in the national interest, as history has demonstrated, it's legally parallel to what Lyndon Johnson was doing in the Gulf of Tonkin in 1964. That's why the Constitution didn't give this power to a president to carry out secretively, but got the whole nation implicated in acts of war, so it would be a national war.
In the last chapter of your book, you outlined 10 proposals that, if enacted, could help the United States end the permanent state of emergency. And at the top of your list, you suggest making it impossible for a president to exercise war powers before Congress has officially declared war. How long has it been since the Congress declared war before presidents began to assume extraordinary wartime powers?
Well, the last declared war was in June of 1942 and with the German allies in Europe. And so look at the undeclared wars we've waged since then. Korea, Vietnam, Panama, I suppose, Persian Gulf I, Persian Gulf II, Iraq, Afghanistan. And none of them have been very happy experiences, not militarily, but more important, not politically.
And then sometimes the president gets support after the fact, like the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, after the United States is pretty much embroiled in Vietnam.
But there
was a difference after the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. It suddenly became a real war, didn't it?
It became a real war, but it didn't become a national war. I think, you know, when we look to World War II as the good war, it's interesting to remember it was also the last declared war, that the whole nation was at war. It wasn't one. When you take shortcuts with Congress and the people, then when things go badly, they can weenie out. And where does that leave our soldiers?
Let's go back to FDR. You only devote one chapter to him, but you credit him with starting a number of the things that have become a commonplace since, like secretly collecting information about political opponents and even private citizens. He worked secretly with J. Edgar Hoover to monitor people he considered subversive. He authorized the FBI to spy on its opponents, and the FBI continued to do that after.
Political opponents, not just subversives, isolationists, political opponents who were not breaking any laws.
Was that the first time you're aware that a U.S. president used government agencies to collect information about people who weren't even suspected of committing a crime?
Well, I didn't take my research back into the 19th century, and I would guess, politics being what it is, it wasn't the first time. But by this point, you had J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. You had communications technology. You couldn't wiretap in the 19th century for a simple reason of technology.
Should we see this as a precursor of what happened when Richard Nixon encouraged Watergate, or when George Bush's administration used warrantless wiretapping?
I think we can see it as why they thought they weren't doing anything that extraordinary, because it had been done before.
And then FDR did something that nobody has done since. He, although maybe Guantanamo might be part of this legacy, he authorized the rounding up of 110,000 Japanese Americans who were held in camps during the war in what would seem to be a violation of the Constitution.
Right. And for suspicion.
Is that like extraordinary rendition?
Well, extraordinary rendition, of course, we send them to faraway black places that don't have torture laws to be tortured. But it's like it, and it's like what we did initially after 9/11 with rounding up naturalized citizens and aliens for no cause other than their ethnicity.
Extraordinary rendition was begun under the Clinton administration, wasn't it?
Well, certainly rendition was. I mean, a rendition is kidnapping people abroad, bring them to the U.S. for trial, which at least we have a due process legal system. This historians debate whether any extraordinary renditions were done under Clinton, but certainly the legal basis for it was laid under Clinton.
My guest is David C. Unger, who's been an editorial writer at the New York Times, where he writes about foreign policy, international economics, and military issues. For more than 30 years, he's been a member of the paper's editorial board. Well, he's been doing that for 30 years, and he's been a member of the editorial board for 22 years. He's also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he teaches courses on American foreign policy at the Bologna Center of the Johns Hopkins University, NITS School of Advanced International Studies in Italy.
Right.
And he's written a book called The Emergency State, America's Pursuit of Absolute Security at All Costs. It is published by the Penguin Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with David C. Unger. His latest book, The Emergency State, America's Pursuit of Absolute Security at All Costs, is published by the Penguin Press. You teach a course in this subject?
I do. I teach America. Well, it's an international graduate school run by Johns Hopkins in Italy, the Bologna Center of Johns Hopkins SAIS, the NITS School. And about half the student body is from the United States and half is from the rest of the world, Europe, Asia, Africa.
Do they see the world similarly and America's role in it?
Well, no, and that's what makes it such an intellectually fertile place, to get those different perspectives working with each other.
Well, I want to return to the military-industrial complex, which I think came into the American consciousness with Dwight D. Eisenhower's speech. But you say this also began under FDR?
Absolutely. Between 1940, fiscal 40 and 41, the defense budget increased ninefold, 900%. You know, Ronald Reagan, eat your heart out. We've never seen anything like that since then.
He created tax breaks and purchasing guarantees to persuade manufacturers to tool up to build the vehicles and weapons that were needed to fight World War II. Did he have to do that? Weren't they going to make enough money without that?
Well, no, because it's a capitalist system and you have to get... He had been in Wilson's administration. He'd been Assistant Secretary of the Navy in the First World War, and he didn't like the command way the government had tried to commandeer the economy then. And he wanted to do it a different way. Remember, this is the end of the Depression, and your Ford Motor Company, you finally have a market for selling cars again. The last thing you want to do is convert your assembly line to some kind of experimental plane or tank that there may be no further market to. So you have to be given guarantees that the money you invest into that is not lost and that there's going to be a market.
So this is the beginning of the cost-plus contracts
this
that we
exactly
still see
today?
This is exactly
the beginning of the cost-plus contract.
And it began then. And it could have ended after World War II, couldn't it?
It certainly could. And what's interesting is Harry Truman became vice president through his experience as chair of the Truman Committee, which was investigating, not because there was a scandal, but making sure this increase in defense spending was not leading to the profiteering that people thought had happened in World War I. So Truman, the first peacetime president, was acutely aware of the nature of the military-industrial complex and what to do about it. But, of course, we went immediately into the Cold War, and we went into panic mode, not that the Soviet Union was not a strategic threat, but we overestimated that threat consistently throughout the Cold War.
You pointed out that FDR's intervention in private industry gave rise to political alliances between the public and private sector that persist today. Haven't these alliances led to a lot of taxpayer money being spent over the years on weapons that are redundant or simply not useful for the kind of fighting that our military can expect to see in the future? We're still making planes that would be very effective against a Soviet threat.
Right. And we're still making planes with, unless you do mid-air refueling, have a 700-mile range, which means that if you want to fight in a place like Afghanistan, you have to make deals with the dictators of other stands, no matter how abhorrent they may be, to get bases there. And it's not a wise policy. But the most important thing is the billions of dollars we spend on unneeded weapons are billions of dollars which could be going to needed weapons or any other national need.
Among your suggestions at the conclusion of your book is that members of congressional appropriations committees should be prohibited from voting on military contracts in their own districts.
Right. That's the ultimate pork, the ultimate earmark, because really what we want to happen in a representative democracy is to weigh the money going to any particular project against alternative uses, including budget cutting, tax cutting, domestic uses, or other military uses. You can't get that if this is jobs in your district or no jobs in your district. You can't expect human beings to ignore that.
And that's why we've seen so many hawks who come from states like Henry Jackson, who was
Boeing.
Called the Boeing senator.
Right. Newt Gingrich, Marietta, Georgia.
And it goes on and on and on. If there's somebody who's making something for some weapon system in your district, you're likely to vote for continuation of that, even if the weapon system is useless. But shouldn't this be one of the issues that the Republican candidates are discussing today?
Should be. When
they talk about cutting back on unnecessary governmental costs?
Yeah. Maybe Ron Paul will. I don't know.
Although FDR may have been the godfather of the emergency state, you've noted that many of the 13 subsequent presidents have made their own original contributions. You know that Eisenhower and Johnson, not George W. Bush, were the first U.S. presidents to distort classified intelligence data to rally the public to support some dubious foreign interventions, such as?
George W. Bush? Or?
Well, no. You say that, well, first it was Eisenhower.
Right.
That was what
Guatemala,
was Guatemala,
Iran.
And Iran.
And Iran. But also, remember, the Bay of Pigs began under Eisenhower also, the planning for that. So that's another dubious one.
And then the Gulf of Tonkin for Johnson.
Gulf of Tonkin for Johnson. Ford and Carter came pretty clean. Desert One maybe for Carter, the Mayaguez for Ford, but nothing major. I think the country wasn't tolerant of undeclared wars in the wake of Vietnam. And Reagan, for all of his hawkish rhetoric, was pretty careful about the use of troops. We had Lebanon, we had Grenada. I think it really exploded again under Clinton because in a very Wilsonian kind of way, and his national security advisor, Tony Lake, was a Wilsonian, it was delinked from the clear strategic interests of the United States, and it was Haiti, and it was the Balkans, and it was humanitarian. There wasn't, I mean, to use our resources, military and financial, properly to make us more secure, you have to make priorities. You have to know what's important.
But we've had all sorts of embarrassments along the line. There was, we had to leave Beirut with our tail between our legs during the Reagan years. We left Somalia under Clinton because of another kind of embarrassment. So don't presidents learn from those things? Or is the assumption always that American military might is so great that we're not going to ever face any kind of humiliating defeat, especially from a small country?
I think they do learn. They don't always learn the right lessons. I think that Reagan felt he'd gotten his hands burned his fingers burned anyway, in Lebanon. And that then we had the Powell Doctrine. We had the Powell-Weinberger Doctrine. If you're going to do it, meet these six tests, come in massively, have the country behind you. I think that was wise. Reagan was pretty restrained. I mean, the Reagan Doctrine in Central America wasn't sending Americans to fight. It was arming local groups and working through the CIA. That wasn't very constitutional, what happened in Iran-Contra, but it was a different kind of violation. I think that having been a journalist through Rwanda and Somalia, I think that very much colored the response to Bosnia and the Balkans and introduced a note of caution. I think one reason I felt that policymakers were reticent about doing Rwanda is they felt that one more defeat in Africa would absolutely make it impossible to make the case they thought they might have to make for Europe later on.
My guest is David C. Unger. His book, The Emergency State, America's Pursuit of Absolute Security at All Costs. It's published by the Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. But we really didn't push very hard in the UN during the Rwanda genocide either. And it's been pointed out that there were some countries that were actually supporting what we see now as the wrong side of that fight.
Like France.
And now we have the situation in Syria,
yeah,
where Russia and China are defending Assad. So is it even possible for a president to do the right thing if you have to live in this real world?
Yes, it is. And I think that we saw some elements of the right thing in Libya, but we didn't meet our own constitutional tests with Congress or even with the War Power Act. But I think there are right ways to do it and wrong ways to do it. In Libya, there was an Arab League call. There was a UN resolution. Obama rather stiffly brags about leading from behind. I think in Rwanda, we fled from behind. So I think it's progress when you get to leading from behind. I think the UN Charter recognizes that there are cases where the whole UN won't go along. It defers to regional organizations like the Arab League. So there are ways to proceed.
One of your suggestions probably won't be all that popular with young people. You suggest that all Americans be required to give 1 year of military service when they turn 18 years old, with the assurance that they won't be sent into combat without a congressional declaration of war. But still, that means everybody has to serve.
It won't be popular, and it isn't popular. But this is Harry Truman's proposal. Harry Truman didn't want to continue selective service after the war. He wanted universal military training, which is very American, very Second Amendment. Not service training. You get the training. Since a lot of the reason we had a draft in the 50s was not to fight a war after Korea was over, but to be able to quickly mobilize to fight a war, if you have people trained. Now, first word, universal. Male, female, straight, gay, inclusive. When you've got that many people in there, you don't have to be grudging about conscientious objection. Anyone who doesn't like using guns or believe in military force can do alternative service. Worked very well for Germany in recent years.
But it also would cost a lot of money, wouldn't it?
Well, it depends. Not necessarily. Well, it depends.
If everybody is going to
work
for the military...
It depends what you pay them. I mean, it's a gap year, right? You know, it's. I mean, Israel does it. It doesn't break the bank. Many countries have gone this way. But the other caveat is that I don't think it's right to call anyone to put their life on the line in an undeclared war if they don't volunteer for it. So the fact that you have training doesn't put you in the army under military command. You have to, unless the country's at war, which is a whole other thing, when the country's not at war, you have to volunteer for service in a combat theater.
Some of your other suggestions include having the United States government declassify any information that's directly germane to debating and deciding foreign and international economic policy issues, with only a few serious national security exceptions. Wouldn't that result in as much as 90% of what's now classified being open to public scrutiny?
Or maybe 95%. You know, a lot of that stuff, it's classified by habit. It's not classified with intent. But its main purpose is to protect the bureaucracy from letting people know what they've decided, particularly political appointees when people are still in office.
Well, if you're proud of what you're doing, why wouldn't you want the world to know?
It's a psychology that takes hold. It's the same psychology that says, I don't want to listen to you may have been an expert on some country, on Tajikistan. You spent your whole career studying it. But I see the classified cable, so I don't have to listen to you. You know,
That's what happened in the run-up to the war in Iraq.
It certainly did. And it's what happened in Vietnam, too. It happened for other reasons, the McCarthyite purge of the China experts. But one thing that secrecy and the emergency state does is there's a lot of taxpayer-paid-for expertise that could steer the United States away from policies that don't make a lot of sense and toward better policies that doesn't even get in on the meetings.
You also suggest that the country's intelligence services be required to publish their budgets each year. Isn't there a requirement already in the Constitution for something like that?
Well, yes, there is. There are lots of requirements in the Constitution. The Constitution says that Congress has exclusive power over international commerce. And yet we have Fast Track, where 600 pages are put before you overnight for an up or down vote. Yes, we don't need a new law for that. It's not only is it technically against the Constitution, it's against the whole spirit of the Constitution to vote on something that you don't know what it is.
You also have called for a charter for the FBI. They've just recently come up with something akin to that, but the FBI has been working since its creation in 1908 or something like that without a charter?
Yeah. Yeah. There was back in the 1970s, the last time America paid serious attention to this issue because of the abuses of the Nixon years and really of the LBJ years too, there was a movement for an FBI charter, but it fell short.
You've said Americans are often the last to know what their government does in their name abroad, and then they're genuinely mystified as to why foreigners seem so anti-American. There was that pushback when France refused to support the United States in Iraq, and we
right.
wound up
freedom fries.
Having freedom fries and
right.
the like. I don't know if any of the people who are calling for them are proud of what they did or whether they're just now going after Mitt Romney for knowing how to speak French.
Yeah, well, I mean, he
should learn how to speak freedom.
We're not big on reflection on what we did in our political debate. But, you know, as a journalist working abroad, as an American now living and teaching abroad, I'm very aware that Americans are often the last to know what their country is doing.
Well, whose fault is that? Isn't that partly the media's fault?
Well,
you work for the New York Times, and sometimes the Times doesn't tell us everything about a story. I wrote a little note asking what senators had voted against a certain bill. They said that 93 voted for and 2 voted against,
right.
and they never told us who the 2 were or why they were opposed.
We used to publish those little small type
boxes.
And
I asked, why don't you do that again? It's 6-point type. It takes up very little space. I was told, no, we need the space. Well, you know, the Times right now has a lot of white space. But that's a whole other matter. Still, is the press doing its job?
Well, as a general point, no. I mean, I think the Times does better than others. I think that when necessary or interesting information, I point to Charlie Savage's articles. It's really the way we know what's going on with the intelligence agencies, and The Times doesn't do all it should, and the run-up to the Iraq War is a spectacular example of that, and the paper has apologized to its readers for its oversight. Apologies are important, and so are learning the lessons and doing better the next time.
Just one more thing before you go. You've posted an obituary on your website that you wrote for Anthony Shadid.
Not me personally.
It wasn't you.
No.
He was a regular guest on the show, and he does represent the other side, the person who's always going out there to get the story.
That's right. That's right. John Burns is another one. We do that. That's what journalism is. You know, we don't sit in offices in New York and think about wars. We send people out on the ground, find out what's going on.
So if journalists do their job, then why do you think Americans remain so unaware of so many of the things that are going on? They're just not interested in it?
I used to be a fifth grade teacher in Brooklyn, and I knew I was doing my job in the 2 or 3 hours a day I had the kids. It was the other 21 hours a day I worried about sort of that.
David C. Unger's book is The Emergency State, America's Pursuit of Absolute Security at All Costs. It is published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.